We're on.
Good afternoon. Gosh, we had a good morning. That was great. We had a terrific update on the state of the school district. Thank you again, Dr. Adams. That was terrific. This is the discussion session. This is our monthly scheduled discussion session, June 3rd. We are being audio recorded, and it will be available on the web. So those who need to hear what we say can hear what we say. And I think, Mr. Morrison, you are getting some copies of the impact study. And I appreciate very much the players we have in the house with us, so we'll let everybody introduce themselves as they start giving some input. My item is impact fees. We have a direction to give. We cannot take a vote. We have a direction to give to the superintendent and staff regarding the impact fee study. You did have that emailed to you, and for some reason I can't pull it up, but I did read it. Don't quiz me on it, but I did read it. And I have to say I was a little surprised at a couple of things in the study, but when we get to that, I'll bring up my couple of questions that I have. So if we could go ahead and get started. Dr. Adams?
Okay, I would like to invite the group to come up to the table, and Mr. Morrison can start the conversation, and then if he wants them to share.
Mr. Sanders, can you sit in the corner?
You sit close.
You sit in the corner, okay. Well, usually it's Mr. Kane who's in the corner, but today it's going to be you.
Thanks. We would like to contact the consultant who prepared the study.
Okay.
That's why we have the spider phone.
Wonderful.
In the middle. If you could just
okay.
Let me.
I'll lean around.
I have to put the code
okay.
in. So.
Okay.
Anyone, let me
you do the whole thing then.
And the consultant's going to be on standby just to to help answer technical questions.
Yeah.
We'll get into this in a moment.
Okay. Just one sheet. Okay.
One sheet. Okay. One sheet.
It'll be good for him to hear what our comments are.
Her, yeah.
Her. I'm sorry.
Sounds good.
I didn't know what it was.
No problem.
Would you like our guests to introduce themselves?
If you would, please, for the record, if
sure.
you could.
Sure. Stan Bowling, County Community Development Director.
I'm Phil Mattson, Indian River County Metropolitan Planning Organization Director.
Hi, Christina. This is Stan Bowling calling from the county for an EGIN, please.
I can take that.
Did a good job.
You have to turn it off.
Okay, here we go.
I should have put Carter Morrison on my pass.
Phil, what's going on with your badge?
Yeah. It's a dry
my hologram
face.
That they put on there is over my face. So every time I go to the school, which is often.
Hi. We're on live.
Okay, very good.
You want to turn it up a little bit more, Carter?
Yes. Just so that you're aware, you have the School Board of Indian River County board members and superintendent in attendance, as well as the board attorney, and Stan and Phil are here, as well as myself.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Neejan, this is Stan. I'm glad you could join us. If you all don't mind, I'll go ahead and start.
Yes, please.
What I'm going to do is give you some background that I have on the one sheet handout.
Sorry, what is the person participating?
Neejan Camp is from Kendall Oliver, the consultant.
Camp.
K-A-M-P.
Mm-hmm. Welcome, Ms. Camp.
We also have Steve Tyndale here, too.
Okay, and Steve Tyndale is also listening in and can comment.
Thank you both for joining us. This is, I speak on behalf of the board. We're very appreciative of that. Thank you so much.
It's our pleasure.
I'll go ahead and start, and the information that I'm going to go over is on the one sheet handout. Then I'm going to turn it over to Phil, and then we can wrap up, and then I think it'd probably be productive to take some questions from you all, and the consultant can answer them. The report that you all saw is a section of the impact fee study that just deals with school impact fees. There's a much bigger report that encompasses other fees that are involved, but we're going to focus on that. But just to give you all a little bit of background, and by the way, Phil and I and Jason Brown, we've also done kind of informational meetings like this to other cities and so forth, so that's we're glad to have the opportunity, so thank you all for having us over. Impact fees can be used only to offset impacts of new growth, and it can only be used for capital items. And as part of a philosophy in this county and in a lot of counties in Florida especially, that growth needs to pay for itself. So when you're kind of calculating the fee, you have to understand what is being consumed, let's say by a house. how many students are going to come, or what fraction of students are going to come from that house, what's the cost of that for providing the service, in this case schools, but also then you have to factor in credit that the new growth, the people in that house are going to be paying other taxes, which are going to go partially for those same kind of services. So you have to look at costs and credit. And Phil's going to get into that in just a moment. Now, we've had traffic impact fees in the county since 1986. We updated those in the 90s and early 2000s. Every time we updated them, they went up substantially, probably mostly because of the cost component of that. In 2005, we added this whole list, and we have a total now of 9 impact fees. That's when we added schools. In 2005, we added schools. And the school impact fee is assessed only for residential development. That's the only development that's going to generate students. And the fee has not changed since 2005. And we have a fee for single-family homes, multifamily homes. We do also have a fee for mobile homes, but we get very, very few of those new mobile homes anymore. So I didn't bother going into that one here. But for a single-family home, you can see here in the bold on your handout, $1,756 per single-family home. That's out of a total fee, for instance, of, say, a 2,000-square-foot home of $8,926 gives you a little idea of the percent. And then for multifamily unit, right now it's $500 out of a total impact fee of all those areas that we charge for, $4,500. There's an interlocal agreement we have with you all since 2005, has not changed, on, you know, taking in impact fees from the county, from the municipalities, transferring it to the school board, and the school board uses those fees for capital projects. We have reduced impact fee rates since 2005 already. Residential has gone down a bit, about 10%. Commercial has already gone down 30 to 60%. Our board has taken some measures to do that. Right now, we're on a cycle of updating impact fees every 3 to 4 years, so we could be back here in 3 or 4 years and getting another consensus and another update. And we have to keep the fees up to date. We have to use the best available data. And in this case now, we're also looking at growth projections and kind of tying that into the fees as well. Last year, we hired Tyndale Oliver and Associates. They've done a lot of work for the county over the last 30 years. They are they're probably the top firm to be doing this. They do impact fee studies all over Florida and beyond. And so we've had a lot of good products from Tyndale Oliver over the years. And last year when our board hired them, it wasn't just to do the update. We said, do something else special this time. And that is to find an alternative method, now that we're in a kind of a more moderate growth environment instead of a really rapid growth environment. Can you come up with a method that will wind up, we'll be able to, in a sense, buy down impact fees for non-residential, kind of reduce non-residential to spur economic development, and without raising residential fees, okay? And they did come up with a rational alternative for that. It's called the affordable growth methodology. We'll describe that to you in just a moment. The consultant's been working with us and your staff for quite a while on getting school data, and your staff checking what they've been doing. And we did have a workshop before our board, and the consultant presented an initial report, but it was without the school impact fee section because it wasn't ready yet. Now that it's ready, we're going to a workshop next week, and we'll get whatever consensus you all have, whatever direction you have, we'll report it to the Board of County Commissioners. Our board's already looked at this affordable growth methodology and has basically accepted it. They did direct us to go out to other groups and to municipalities that were interested to present information, and we're basically doing that this afternoon for you all, and we appreciate it. On April 22nd, our board went ahead with non-residential impact fees and adopted those and reduced those. We didn't need the school impact fee issue to be settled for that. But now to finish the process, we do need school impact fee issue to be basically to be finalized. There are other issues we're also going to address next week, some implementation issues that really probably don't involve you all to much degree. So what we're looking for from you all this afternoon is input, like we've gotten from some of the other local governments. And, again, a workshop next week on June 11th, and your staff will need to be there because I think really the end of this equation that you all are really involved in, or your staff, I should say, really is involved in, is not only, you know, what's the proper impact fee rate, what's the defensible rate, but there's also some policy decisions. Policy decision on actually whether or not to charge an impact fee in the first place, If you do, is it defensible? That's where this report comes in. But then even beyond that, if you decide to continue to collect impact fees, what do you have on the horizon to spend them on? Just to make sure that the spending side is what obviously you all are involved in, especially your staff. And so they'll need, and they'll be prepared, you know, next week's workshop to answer those kinds of questions. But ultimately, we're looking for direction from our board next week, and we'll report to them your direction or your consensus. And then we're hoping that in July, they'll be ready and we'll be ready to go with a residential impact fee schedule for them to adopt. And then we'll go through this all again in about 3 or 4 years. So that's all that I had. I'd like to turn it over to Phil now to go into a little bit more of the calculation side of things.
Good afternoon. Phil Mattson, Indian River County MPO. And I'm going to take you into the whys and the hows of the impact fee a little bit. Why we're levying one in the first place, how we set the fee, get into a little bit of the technical subject matter of the report, and then the consultants on hand to answer questions that might follow up my presentation. But to begin with, it's fundamentally a sustainability and sustaining quality of life type issue. What we want to do is maintain a quality of life that's attractive, that helps support the economic development of the county, that gives people a reason to call this place home and to be proud. And frankly, that's why I'm here. It's for the schools. I moved here when my baby was 6 months old. They're doing great. That baby is now in Storm Grove. It went pretty quick. My daughter's in Sebastian High School, IB program. I absolutely love the school system. But we want to set a level of service and meet that level of service. And this gives you the opportunity to do that, or it gives you one tool to do it. And my second bullet's pretty important. We're not looking to grow the pie or get more funding for construction for the sake of construction spending. It's more a shifting of the burden of growth. If you buy into the philosophy that some of this growth, which is necessitating some of this new capacity, should be accountable for the expenses, then the impact fees are the mechanism for doing that, because they're assessed on the newcomers coming in. And finally, they are a capacity program only. You can't use this for operating. It doesn't give you the opportunity to hire teachers, drive buses, anything like that. So those are probably the three most fundamental things I think everyone should know about fees, and it explodes a few of the myths out there, too. Now, how we set the fees, you have to first choose an acceptable, legally defensible methodology, and we use consultant services, and any smart jurisdiction would do that, because there's really sophisticated engineering, planning, and legal questions involved in this. And the firm we got to give you a little introduction, Tyndale Oliver, they've done over 200 jurisdictional impact fees. So they have tremendous amounts of experience, and as Steve Tyndale likes to say, who's actually joined us on this call, they've never been successfully challenged in court on any of those fees. You know, people occasionally say, why are you, it's too much on the housing, not enough on the businesses, or vice versa. But they've come up with a very technical, very tight, well-reasoned report and method. And the method is what I want to talk about here. First of all, there's consumption-based and improvement-based methods. And we've selected a consumption-based method, and I have a couple of illustrations coming up that'll show you what that means. And then, as Stan mentioned, we've been charged with coming up with a way of seeing what we can do about the business impact fees to get more jobs in the county, you know, to reduce the burden to the extent possible on new businesses and enterprises relocating here while holding the line on the residential fees as well, or reducing them somewhat. So that's the second part of what I'm going to talk about in methodology. So to start, we have an improvements-based fee, and you're going to see two illustrations here. And an improvement-based fee, it makes it incumbent on staff and its consultants to estimate the future facilities. And then based on what we think, we geniuses think the population's going to be in the future, go ahead and levy a fee and build the infrastructure that'll be there in time for the population to show up. The problem is, what if you're wrong? What if you've overestimated that and you end up with roads to nowhere and lots of extra infrastructure? And that's illustrated in the second thing. We don't do this. We don't do an improvements-based fee. We do a consumption-based fee. And Stan pointed to this cup before as a county house. We do have houses that look like that, by the way. But each house comes in, and it creates units of consumption, a little bit of road, maybe one jail bed. Some houses more than one jail bed, you know. Student stations, whatever. So each unit that comes in generates what we can boil down to a unit of consumption. And in a slow period like this, you have a fee that's based on a unit of consumption, small amounts of revenue will come in, but that's okay because that's about the level of expenditure that you need. And if you look at the second slide, and it just kind of makes it obvious, when lots of development is coming in, then your impact fee coffers start to swell. So it's sort of a self-regulating mechanism of imposing a fee, and it doesn't apportion too much of future expenses on a small amount of people coming in, which is why we like this method. The impact fee formula, as Stan mentioned, we levy 9 of these, but they're all basically boiled down to the same thing. It's demand times cost minus a credit, and that's what your fee comes down to. So demand is based on a level of service that you adopt. Here it's not overcrowding the schools. You know, it's 100% fish capacity. But what we do to determine how we meet demand is what's the student generation rate per household, or the unit per cup, or if you will. And then the cost, what we do is update every time we do an impact fee update. And I don't know if Stan mentioned this, but every few years we have to do another update. We take a look and see what the construction costs are statewide, what we're paying here. We take a look at a wide range of data, which Neigen can kind of fill you in on, to get the latest and greatest costs to make sure our fee is still relevant. And that's for everything, classrooms, buses, and ancillary facilities. So any capital expenditure that you make, we take into consideration in the cost component of the fee. Now, the credit, that house that comes in is still going to be paying school taxes. It's still going to be paying gas taxes on the transportation fee, et cetera. So we have to credit that back to the individual fee payer in order to have a legally defensible fee. So those three components go into every fee formula. Now, once we've established the fee and the fee level that's appropriate here by taking a look at construction costs and updating all of that, by taking a look at how many people per household there are and students per household and et cetera, we take a look at what we can do to potentially reduce the fee. And this chart is the affordable growth method. And what this curve is saying, basically, if you're in a normal or a high growth rate, as we were in the earlier parts of the last decade, you need to charge your fee at 100%, or the red line here on this chart, in order to maintain level of service. And this is a different curve for every different fee, because transportation isn't necessarily the same level of discount. You know, people drive, driving patterns, attend school, et cetera, they all have a different generation and different rate. But the red line is what you have to charge, and it approaches 100% as you get into 3, 4, 5% growth and above. The affordable growth method is a variation on a technique we've used and other jurisdictions have used for a long time by taking some of those other revenues that are available, subsidizing your impact fee. So you don't have to charge the same fee because the differential between the fee you are charging at a slower rate of growth, which is where the green line intersects the purple, and where the red line intersects the purple, you're going to have enough revenue to pay that difference. So the fee has to be set at where the green hits the purple, which is approximately 28% of the actual cost. And once again, that's because you have other revenue sources that will enable you to charge a less fee at slower rates of growth. What does that mean for us? Well, let's take a look at what we are currently charging, what we can charge as a maximum fee, and what, given our rate of growth, we are proposing to charge under this, or what you can charge under the legally defensible affordable growth fee. Current fee now, from our last study, which was the father of that study, was in 05, and I think we updated it in 09, probably didn't touch it, but $1,756 for a single-family home, $500 multifamily, $623 mobile home. The maximum fee, obviously, because the cost of things go up, because different bond issues and so forth and the credit component retire, much higher. At the affordable growth rate, given our rate of growth and what conditions are now, we see a single family fee of $54 less than what we're charging now. So we're looking at a reduced fee. The multifamily and mobile home components of the fee go up. And the reason for that is, one thing we do is we take a GIS analysis of the county, where all the different homes are. Then we take the school rosters, which, you know, we needed your help getting from the IT department, without the names, you know, all that was redacted, but addresses. And we reconciled what kind of houses we have in the county from our database with where the students live. And we had a pinpoint idea of how many students are living in each of these three categories of homes. So, you know, over time these things change, and a lot of the multifamily stuff that's gone up in this county has been, like some of the stuff out at Fellsmere and some of the stuff at Gifford, have been low and moderate income. There tend to be larger families in those kinds of things. So it is intuitive that that would have gone up a bit, whereas the single family went down. But that's our proposed educational impact fee. That's our methodology in a nutshell. Every component of that fee is supported by technical data. We've hired a consultant that has a lot of experience in this, including legal experience, to guide us through it. And that consultant, especially Nijin, she's been wonderful and really has an encyclopedic knowledge of everything and every fee component. You know, I can call her up and say, hey, what are you assuming for the cost of a county two-lane collector? You know, and she goes, oh, that's $7,800, you know, whatever, per mile, and really, really pulls these things out at her fingertips. So grateful to have it. That's pretty much all I really wanted to tell you.
And if I could wrap up, I know this is a crash course in this, and but, you know, I guess we're better than the school board, right, to do that. A few things. You know, the way that I conceive myself of the affordable growth methodology is this, since really there's a blend of revenues that are paying for the capital expansion. It's not just all impact fees. It's other sources as well. And in a slower growth environment, those other non-impact fee sources have longer to accumulate and save up until you have to build another school, in our case, build another roadway. So you've got more non-impact fee accumulation that's happening. It's being paid by taxpayers and whoever manages to move in a slow growth environment and start paying as well. So you don't have to you don't have as much catch-up to do. And so impact fees can essentially be bought down by that accumulation of the other revenues. And that's essentially, it's intuitive, it makes sense, and I think the consultants found that it works. Again, it's something that with this sort of methodology now, from now on, whenever we do an impact fee update, we'll also be looking at growth rates as well. Because that now becomes a factor in our formula to see, well, how did we do the last 3 years? So that'll be updated as well. I also wanted to mention really two other things and then see if Nijin or Steve had anything they wanted to get out to you guys and then go with the questions. One is, if you look at page 10 of the report that Nijin sent you, if you have it with you. If you don't, maybe you have a photographic memory. if you use that memory to memorize tables, my condolences. But table Roman numeral 2-1, county enrollment. Now, this is information we got from you all that you got from DOE. And I think one of the issues that has come up in discussions, certainly at our level, and I think will come up next week at the workshop, is, hey, look, right now, district-wide, student enrollment is pretty much flat and looking to be flat until you get a few more years out, and then it starts to pick back up again. Now, whether there are demographic you guys have demographic oscillations, I think, and given the size of our district, that we don't have for the kind of services the county provides, but you guys see it. I mean, you see some little mini waves come through. Demographics is something I know you guys are well-versed in. So there may be reasons for that as well as growth. But one of the issues that comes up is, well, look, okay, you figured out the maximum fee you can charge for each person that is statistically going to add. Growth methodology, you know, buys it down, and we're about to where you guys are charging, have been charging it for a while. And if you look at the tables that are in the report, you'll see Indian River County at the affordable growth level, $1,702, the lowest one in the state in terms of the ones that are ranked there. That's in the report as well. Nonetheless, policy decision in a slower or flat enrollment time, if these projections hold true, what would you spend the money on if you got impact? If you continue to collect impact fees, what would you spend the money on? Now, I know your staff knows the answer to that question. I've heard it, so I know it. I know you guys know it. But it's really incumbent, I think, upon the school district to answer that question. You know, what can it be spent on? What is it needed for? But it's still a policy decision because you all have control over your revenues. And if you didn't want to have impact fees at all, you could say, we want to suspend them until the next update. So there are policy decisions. Now, the Board of County Commissioners has, for the most part, gone with the affordable growth methodology with a few policy adjustments. And we've had policy adjustments some up and a few of them down and reduced from affordable growth methodology, but for various reasons. One is, I'll tell you, our emergency services. We know we have a couple of new fire stations coming on in our next 5 years, capital intensive. So we're not buying down the emergency services impact fee. Libraries, we're suspending all the way down to zero. But libraries, not only do we not have any public libraries we're looking to build in the next 5 years, but actually going further out on the horizon, we're not, you know, that whole service, that whole industry is changing because of technology. So we're not even looking long term that are we really going to be doing big branch libraries anymore 15 years from now? Well, maybe not. So for right now, our board has decided to suspend those fees. And those, again, once you do all the up and down, residential impact fees look like they're going to remain approximately flat or maybe down just a little bit. Does some of that obviously depends on what, you know, what input we get from you all today. But I did want to get into that issue of what are some of the policy decisions you all could make, and what is the response to the current kind of slow enrollment environment. That is going to be an answer that you guys are going to be there, or your staff's going to be there to give next week.
Do we want to hear from Ms. Camp and Mr. Tyndale first, or do you want to hear from Mr. Morrison first?
Whatever.
Ms. Camp, Mr. Tyndale, do you have anything you wish to add at this moment?
No, I think Stan and Phil gave a very good overview, so we're just here to respond to any questions you all may have.
Okay, now you get to listen to Mr. Morrison and the school district representative, so... Thank you.
Part of their mission is to listen, too, because we do have this wrap-up, mm-hmm. So
well,
I'm happy.
Can I give just one little snippet of history that I think there are members of your county commission who don't know that when this last study was done, I believe it was 2007, 2008 mm-hmm. time frame, that the suggestion from the consultant at that time, remember, we were still kind of riding a little bit of the up wave that we had, suggestion from the consultant at that time, based on all the figures they were using their formulas, mm-hmm. was that it almost twice what the existing 2005 figures mm-hmm. were.
Yep.
And as a board, the board took a position, and we requested of the county commissioners that they not take the school district impact fee as presented, but that we, because it was, and I believe it's on page 13, you talk about land cost, and land cost was a bit skewed because of the 66th Avenue purchase mm-hmm. on land cost. So they were using their formula, which was appropriate, but that board was not the board that made this decision. Actually, the only one left on that was Ms. Disney and myself. But we made the decision not to go with that suggested increase because we felt as though that was very unfair. So we, as a board, wrote a letter to the commissioners and said, please leave it at the 2005 level. Right. But I just think that's, especially for your commissioners, they're mm-hmm. not going to know that we turned down an opportunity. We were not greedy. We just, and we weren't seeing what we really needed at that time, or where we were going to be going. But I think that's an important component.
It is, and in fact, our board did not accept that report either, because the timing of the report, unfortunately, was, like you said, it was at, I mean, the peak prices of the boom were reflected in that report, and it was skewed, and things had already started to drop
that's
by the time, by the time it got to the decision makers.
Yeah, the wave was coming back
Yeah,
down.
It was coming back down, but you're exactly right. The school board made a policy decision at that time. We're not asking for any more increase, and the board did not increase it.
Right.
And the board wound up coming, kind of shelving that 2007 study. In 2009, did an update on the traffic only and dropped those. But no, you're exactly right. So policy decisions have been made in the past.
Well, but the final say will be the commissioners, and I do think it's important that that is a nugget that they need to have when they're putting their chips in for discussion. They need to know that we had an opportunity, mm-hmm. and because of where we were, we did not take that opportunity, because we still saw some growth.
Certainly.
Okay, Mr. Morrison, I'm sorry to have taken
up
your time.
What you have in front of you is just some information to help you in your consideration and giving some consensus.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of numbers on this page, but I'd just like to focus you on the area that says by total fiscal year. It's on the left-hand side of the page there, on my handout. On my handout.
One
sheeter that I sent around. There you go. As you can see, in fiscal 2008, we collected over $715,000. And then as the recession took hold, you can see we had a drop down to $291,000 in 2009, 278,000, 2011, $331,000, and in 2012, $400,000. So the height of the collection, if you will, was at that time in 2008. But what we've seen in fiscal 2013 is a gradual increase up to $713,000. And fiscal year to date, when we presented this report to the county commissioners, in April was about $666,000. Today, we have collected over $870,000. And what we're seeing in terms of the monthly collections that are coming in are from the unincorporated areas and areas in the north, in the Fellsmere region. Something also to consider is we have received some information from the villages of Fellsmere. There's a project that seems to be in the mix. Whether or not that's going to happen within the next 3 to 4 years, we don't know. But it is for 19,750 single-family homes. And there are also some pros and cons to whether or not the school board would want to keep a fee, levy a fee, suspend the fee. And we just wanted to encapsulate that for you, that if the board keeps the fee, if construction does pick up, then we would already have the fees on hand to build a school up in the north. It would amount to about $33 million if you were to take that 19,750 houses times the fee that we have put forward. As the board, a board decision to keep the fees in place would set a precedent when the decision is reevaluated in the future. Having the fee in place would help to avoid any debate whether or not you're going to reinstate a fee. But there are also some cons to it. As we've showed on the report, the COFTE data shows that we're not growing. For the next year, couple of years, and until 16, 17, we don't turn around. If housing construction remains stagnant and those students are experienced, it will be hard to justify collecting a fee. The district could look bad down the road if we had to refund those fees if we didn't have that growth. If the board suspended the fee, again, there are some pros and cons. It would be a easier path to follow, so to speak, and it could potentially contribute to economic growth. Not really sure if a $1,700 decision on a house would sway someone one way or the other. And if the fee is suspended, it could be difficult to reinstate it down the road, as we know. So just some information to weigh as you make your decision on whether or not to keep the fee, suspend the fee, or accept the report that is presented today.
Thank you, Mr. Morrison. Board questions? Yes, Ms. Disney.
Thank you, Mrs. Johnson. One variable that isn't included in any of the equations is the class size amendment. And 10 years ago, when class size amendment started chasing us, we were not able to keep up. So we're still in a pattern of needing to build classrooms to accommodate students that are housed in temporary facilities because of class size amendment. Because an elementary school that may have held 500 kids now holds 400 kids because of class size amendment. So we have all these portables out there. We've done a really good job without borrowing money of putting in some permanent classroom space. But we're still not finished with all that. So while we're flat, while our growth is flat, there's still classrooms that are not built.
Can we use them? We can use impact fee money to replace temporary classrooms with permanent classrooms.
Yes, you can use it to replace portables. That's correct. Right.
And it might be good to have the consultant chime in on that too. We've had that conversation. Did you hear that, Nijin? Replacing portables with permanent student stations?
Yes. Yeah, we don't include the portables in the inventory because of that policy, the district's policy of really not relying on portables on a long-term basis. So then when you build a new station to replace it, it's almost like building a brand new from nothing.
Right.
So you can absolutely use the impact fees for portables.
Right.
So, Ms. Camp, you're saying it's defensible?
It is.
Yes. Yes,
okay.
It is noted on page 11 of the report, the very last paragraph at the bottom. Portable stations will always be used at some level since they provide valuable flexibility to address temporary increases in enrollment and the school district's policies to provide the necessary permanent stations in the long term. So it is noted in the report.
Ms. Sanchez?
Yes, I just want to for clarification first. The meeting is next Wednesday, the 11th. In the county commission?
That's correct.
And it is a public workshop?
It
or
is.
Or is it an action?
It's a public workshop.
Okay.
Yeah.
It helps. It's not really a question, but if I'm understanding this, it's based on consumption. So whether we, and we just had a conversation before the meeting about having a seat on the MPO, trying to just sit and have it, I don't feel that we should suspend things. That's my feeling. If it's based on consumption, then it moves at its own rate. And so, I, as I said, and you made a perfect example of the class size. I wouldn't be in favor of removing or suspending. It's the problem solves itself. It's based on consumption, so we're not overcharging anyone. I kind of got the feeling that there was a, well, it could look bad if it keeps going down in 3 years when we evaluate it. That's really not the choice of the commission. That would be the choice of the board. And again, if it's based on consumption, then, you know, no harm, no foul, because it's based on consumption. It's a true formula that you're saying is most important, as with, I would say, trips on a road or anything like that.
Right.
I feel it's consumption-based, so there's no need to defend it. So that's just...
Ms. Jimenez. Yes, I have a question. When you were going over the demand formula, you mentioned the population, how many students were serving. And on page 10, we have, you know, the numbers for every academic year. And it says K through 12. And I guess this is more a question for the superintendent. Is there any impact that we should be mindful of given all of the pre-K classrooms? For example, if you look at the fish capacity for Vero Beach Elementary, there's, I don't know how many spaces, student stations, that are being used for pre-K, and that is not just at VBE, it's at other schools. And so that skews the demand to a certain extent, I would think. Does it? Would it?
They are not in this number. The pre-K ESC would be in this number because we have FTE for that. However, the VPK pre-K programs would not. Okay, so we have, I don't know, six or seven classrooms, I think, at Vero Beach Elementary.
Right.
We have a couple at Fellsmere. Huh. We have, you know, most of them are blends, but you're right, okay. But the pre-K ESE would be part of this, but our VPK would not.
Right, and then my question is, isn't that, in effect, part of the demand? I mean, we're using that space for classrooms, but it's not being taken to account in that formula, if I heard you correctly.
No, I don't think it would be.
Yeah, and I'm going to direct that back to the consultant. I guess some of the permanent student stations in the elementary schools are used for VPK. And I'm just wondering if that doesn't have the effect of inflating inventory and the conditions are actually more crowded in a sense than we think they are, because while they appear full, they're full of the students that are not considered in this table.
Isn't VPK during the summer?
It's both actually.
Both school year.
It's during the school
okay.
year and in the summer. For students who do not go in the during the school year, they have the opportunity to send to go during the summer.
Okay. If a substantial amount or a good amount that's already using up some of the stations, that would affect the available capacity. And when they do apply, you do take them in. There's really no limitation as far as, you know, if we don't have room that we don't offer to VPK.
That's correct.
Yes,
that's correct.
So how many current VPK classrooms do we have in the county?
I'm not sure of that.
3-year-old classes, right?
Yeah, that's a pre-K ESE. We don't want to mix the two, okay?
Yeah.
So I'd say we have between 10 and 12, I think,
okay.
VPK, all standalone.
So we have 10
classes.
To 12 throughout the county, 10 to 12 classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, yes, it does appear that we have, as you said, Mr. Matson, we have excess inventory of available space when we really don't have that.
Right. And it may be good to reflect that, to get some data from your staff and reflect that in the report, that in addition to into this table that we're looking at here on page 10, there's also capacity is being taken up by
yep.
VPK.
And now that Mrs. Disney mentions that, we must serve the pre-K ESE, so those three-year-olds and four-year-olds that are fall under, you know, exceptional students, we must provide services for those. So that is another space that's not taken
whether
into consideration.
Or not.
Yes, that's correct.
And that's how many classrooms?
I don't know. I'd have to.
Okay, but that's all part of the information.
Yeah,
we'll incorporate that into the report, and it'll have an effect. That's good.
Ms. Jimenez.
Yeah, and as a follow-up, in your Appendix 1, where you have your fish capacity, does this, you know, these just look like the raw numbers for fish capacity, and I know that in the past, the fish capacity does not necessarily reflect the usage. For example, if you have a classroom that seats 20 students and you have five ESE students in there with their respective aides, is the calculation going to be based on 20 or is it going to be based on the actual five? And in each school, it will present itself differently. Mm-hmm. If you have an autism unit in a school, that is going to be a little bit different than a school that doesn't. And is that, again, I'm just concerned about that demand.
Yeah.
No, these are things that we as non-educators don't think of.
Right.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and I think, we're looking at some pretty rough averages when you get to something that fine-grained. Mm-hmm. But you're right, there are programmatic reasons why you have usage and utilization rates that you have, but that's as far as you just heard the extent of my knowledge on that. But we have to go with that. And I think really, and the consultant can speak to this if she wants, I think we're basically, the table A1, we're just using rough, basically we're using the averages right now.
Ms. Disney.
Thanks. So when I look at the formula that you use, which is the student generation rate, it's not multi-tiered, so then we're just using an average, right? Like the entry-level home with lots of students.
Page 22,
And you're averaging that with the...
That's correct. Every single family home, is, regardless of the size, is looked at as an average because you also have the life of that home and the people who occupy it. You may have somebody with no kids, and then 5 years later, a family. So you really have to use averages, and averages really do work in the aggregate, and that's really where we are with this.
So, is there any exemption for these over 55 communities that have net?
That's great question. There is. If you and it's true for school concurrency, and it's true for school impact fees. If a community comes in, it can't be a single house. It has to be a community comes in with a permanent restriction to 55 or over, they will be exempt from paying school impact fees. And we've not had a community come in to do that, I think for marketing reasons. Where we've had developers ask us about, well, we're thinking about doing that, we say, look, if you decide to do that, we want the county to be a party to that covenant. So that covenant cannot go away without the county releasing it, because if you ever come in and release that covenant, you owe impact fees. That's been available for 9 years, and no one has done it to this point. But yes, a community could do that. To date, no developers have expressed to us the desire to limit their project to that.
But when you look at, which we talked about in one of the planning and zoning meetings, I think it was, but if you look at D.R. Horton coming in, everybody sees all this growth going on. Well, those impact fees have already been paid, because they have bought up existing. Sure. By the same token, you get a Del Webb or someone of that magnitude in here to build an over 55, and I think we're probably ripe in this community for that kind of a, within the next few years, that kind of a developer to come in. But a Del Webb, all of their communities are over 55, and they're up and down the East Coast and the West Coast. So why we haven't been hit yet, I don't know. But they're not quite south enough on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. But they, you know, West Coast and the northern East Coast, Jacksonville, St. Augustine, all of those huge number of the Del Webb communities, and they're all over 55.
Yeah, it might be the size of the land that's available. We have a lot of 200-acre tracts,
sure.
Not a lot of 2,000-acre tracts.
Sure, mm-hmm. And they're big developments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I mean, they're. You know, they generate by numbers, sheer numbers.
Maybe if the Villages of Fellsmere happens, one of the villages might be the old folks' village.
Right. Sure.
There is construction going on in Waterway again. Is it Waterway?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, they're on the second of seven phases?
Yes.
Yeah. Something like that.
Ms. Disney, go ahead.
So when you talk about some of the policy decisions and implications, are you talking about things like mitigation, impact fee credits, if they were to build the school, then...
That is already addressed in the ordinance, and there is the ability for someone to come in and negotiate for credits, and we've not had anybody do that, but that's already allowed in the code.
Right.
What we're really focused on right now is the fee itself, the update of the fee and the affordable growth approach, and then if you want to make a policy decision to do something other than the affordable growth. That's really what this afternoon's about.
Such as it requires a majority vote of the board kind of thing.
I think just a consensus would be fine.
Yeah. Actually, today, I think the intent for today is to just give a consensus that, or to say, you know, no, we do take exception to this because of what we have found. I mean, we didn't get any capital funds for 3 years
PICO
in a row.
PICO
for 3 years. So, you know, they were there, but they didn't come to the traditional schools. So I think that's the philosophy. Ms. Simchick was kind enough to go ahead and state a position, so I think we need at least two other responders, but we're not polling the board, so we need at least two other responses. Yes, Ms. Disney?
I'll do that. We have a perfect example right now in the projects that we're funding with impact fees, Fells Elementary, for instance, about...
And citrus, yes.
About the value of those impact fees and the ability for the board to move forward with needed facilities without having to borrow money. So I will state a position not to suspend.
Okay. And Ms. Jimenez?
Okay. And this is probably beyond your purview, but I just wanted to understand a comment that I heard when looking at this, at the proposal. You mentioned that the multifamily homes would probably, you know, they're low income.
Affordable, I think.
Affordable.
Yeah.
Okay. And so I was just curious, looking at the change column, that if you have a single family home, their fee is going to decrease. And that's a family that's probably a little bit more affluent. But a multifamily home that is affordable housing is going to be paying even more.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody that lives in a mobile home is going to be paying even more.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just the result of your formula?
I think what it is, and Nijin, you can pipe in and correct me or add to it, but I think what we found, and Phil went into this, the student generation rates, I think, have changed for those types of homes. You know, when you think about multifamily, does he hear a yes, Nijin?
Okay. Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah,
and you think about locally here, you know, 15 years ago, maybe it was mostly retirees or empty nesters in condos, and maybe that has shifted now. And I think Phil alluded to that. So that demographic has changed into who's, you know, going into those types of units. And the same with mobile homes. You think about all the mobile home communities out west on 60. All 55 and over, year after year, where now some of them have changed, and they're letting, you know. So I think you're getting non-retirees in multifamily mobile home units more now than you were 15 years ago. Now, I will say that the counties, by suspending library impact fees, it takes the impact fees down for single-family, mobile home, and multifamily. So even though the school rate may be going up some on those, with the Board of County Commissioners' direction, I think overall the residential fees will either be flat or down a little bit. That's just in terms of the big picture.
Yeah.
Given
and
the consensus
and
I heard.
And another way to look at it, the fee is going down on the mobile homes and all pretty much all the uses in the county. The pie slices are changing size, but the pie itself is shrinking. You have younger families coming in, they pay a higher fee, but that's schools, but that's the school component of the overall fee. They use less emergency services than would seniors or somebody who might be in the same thing. So I guess what I'm trying to say is the fee is generally shrinking. The demographics of the user base in each type of dwelling unit change to reflect what the demand is that they are creating. So there'll be less emergency service calls and that sort of thing, as well from the younger and lower income families.
So will their fees
and that will mitigate
decrease
this. Yes.
Their fees will be
they would have been higher otherwise.
Okay. Right.
Ms. Simchick?
I do want to comment on something that Mr. Morrison said that about, I mean, no, they're not going to build 19,000 homes in 3 years, but they did modify their comp plan to just recently because they got their first nibble of their commercial industrial building, and they want 3 elementaries and a middle school in that 19,000 home area. But as I said, they are, it's taking off. It's not just a, you know, something on the map. It's actually in the process, and they did modify their comp plan to accommodate this new growth in their city. So that's very, you know, we should be mindful of that because it's just reinforcing my position.
Okay, Mr. McCain, did you have any comments on this issue?
All right. Well, our attorney has something to say. Listen up, folks.
No, just a question, just so that the board can have a fuller discussion if warranted. With regard to the affordable growth methodology used, and perhaps this is for the Tyndall Oliver representatives, can you share with the school board in what other jurisdictions you've used this methodology for educational impact fees?
Ms. Camp, Mr. Tyndall, did you hear the question?
We haven't used it for educational facilities. We used it for transportation. City of Orlando adopted it. Pasco County adopted it. City of Albuquerque, New Mexico adopted it. And I think Hernando County. But it wasn't, they were mostly all transportation. But it was the same methodology. It just happened to be that those fees were being updated. And that's one of the highest fees, so that's where people concentrate on most things like.
Yeah, I think in general, the affordable growth strategy has been primarily used to discount non-residential. It's been using taxes to buy down it and has not been heavily used in the way you're using it here in terms of looking at the total of all uses and maybe discounting them. So I think that's the basic answer. I'd like to highlight again that we've given y'all 2 numbers, the low number and the high number, and you've made and the low number is based on averages and very, very, you know, fairly conservative methodology, and you just made a list of reasons why somewhere between the low and the high number, your geographic demand is involving you sometimes the average, the countywide average. Your demand by individual school type doesn't allow you to use the overall average. We've got a lot of the school systems aren't using it because they're having to move most of their tax money into reconstruction because they've been around for 30, 40 years and they're projecting the future not to have the taxes available. So there's a whole list of reasons that's what we want to do to talk about of why to adopt something between one that's currently the lower number and then the one that we think that you don't want to exceed, which is the higher number.
More board discussion?
Yes, Ms. Jimenez.
So he was referring to this when he was talking?
Yes.
This affordable. So the cost is the blue line. This is what it would actually cost to build whatever schools or whatever facilities are needed to serve the population that's growing. But we want to stay at 28% because we have other revenue sources that will help us reach the 100.
And Steve, I don't know if you're looking at our slides, but I'm showing the affordable growth curve. The red is what you can charge. That's the maximum fee you can charge through impact fees.
Right.
The blue.
The difference between red. Yeah, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Yes, that's correct. And that curve is generated by a policy decision to use projected future tax revenues to meet your standards. And like I'm saying, in many of our school boards, they don't have the projected revenues that y'all are spending on capital. They're almost taking all of that and moving into reconstruction, and that curve would be straight across. We wouldn't be able to draw that curve because the future tax revenues aren't available.
Yeah, I think what that really means, and this kind of goes, Ms. Johnson, to your point about in the past, I think the school board's been using other revenues besides impact fees quite heavily for capital, and this is kind of a continuation of that. And my guess is if you ask the consultant point blank, should you suspend fees, I think he'd say no. So I think, you know, I think that's where this conversation is.
Yes, Ms. Mendes. Yeah, but we've been borrowing money ad nauseum in order to do this, and I think that's another reason why we need to maintain these fees because that's just not sustainable to carry so much debt.
Right.
Ms. Simpson, our attorney gave me some food for thought. Out of the 200 plus jurisdictions that you said Tyndall
has done fees for,
why are we, if we're the only one that we're using the affordable growth formula, why are we the only one or going to be the new? And I don't mean to be rude. Is this easier because then affordable growth methodology will be everything for the county and it's easier for your reciprocal of, you know?
Well, I think, first of all, the county's going to have to make the board's going to have to make the decision about charging fees, and we need a good technical basis for it that's defensible. Mm-hmm. I think we've got that with this. I think the other thing, too, is that, you know, in looking at what your five-year program is, you know, and what you can be using this money for, what growth-initiated items you have, you know, I don't know that it's expansive. You're not in a huge expansion mode yet. You might see that maybe more 5 to 10 years out instead. So I think you've got to be cognizant of that, and that we're going to have another update in 3 years. So I think, to me, this is actually kind of a middle-of-the-road sort of approach.
Plus, as Disney was saying, when we're dealing with all of these portables that are aging out mm-hmm. and that we're paying for, I mean, we're paying monthly rental for, it behooves us to, even though we're in a pretty flat growth pattern, for us to be taking care of business,
certainly,
which wasn't done for so many years. We did not take care of business. So this would allow us to at least move along and take care of, I mean, we have 11 portables here and 13 portables there, and, you know, I mean, it's a goal that this board has, by consensus, said we want the best learning environment. And as we all know, even though we talk about all these sheltered walkways, well, when it comes to rain, it never rains straight down in the state of Florida. It never has, never will. It just doesn't happen that way.
Yeah.
But that's not the best environment for kids trying to get back and forth to computer classes or to media centers or whatever. It's just not acceptable, and that's what we're trying very hard to address. And with this, we would be able to still address some of it, the most egregious. We would not be able to address them all.
Right.
I will tell you that our laundry list is much longer than what this is going to give us, in the best of circumstances.
I can't imagine that you would ever not have portables in any school system.
You can't.
Yeah. You can't predict who shows up on day one. There's no way you could. If you could do that, that'd be scared.
That would be a handful.
Right.
And we are not talking about schools having a handful.
Right.
We're talking about schools that have a huge number, an acceptable number.
Ms. Simpson,
oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, as you were thinking, one of the other things that impacted us more than people would realize is we closed a school. So we closed 550 spaces, which then in turn filled our other schools. So we're not talking about space at schools, and that's why the portable issue, you know, because there isn't space. Portables do become a reality when there is any growth, but that did make a huge change in the space that we had available once we closed Osceola Magnet.
But for a point of clarification, we closed because we were not willing to rebuild a new school. We weren't willing to put forth and borrow to build a new school.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so we had to take care of the situation we had at Osceola, which impacted other schools. So, I mean, that clarification needs to be out there because that's a criticism I hear constantly. Mm-hmm. Why do you need impact fees when you actually closed a school? And is that statement incorrect? No, it's not incorrect. However, it's sort of like going before the judge and you say, guilty, Your Honor, with an explanation. So, not that I've ever done that, but it's...
Yeah.
I think it's really important that we realize that, you know, and we have had great support from our community on issues. You know, passing that referendum, we were the only school district in Florida that passed a referendum that year, and that was to support all this technology infrastructure where we're mandated to have. So, you know, we don't want to thumb our nose at the community, including the business community. And I was thrilled in here. My old Chamber of Commerce hat. I was thrilled in here at what the stimulus for
for economic development. Mm-hmm. My hat's off to you all. That's not an easy stand to take, but I'm good for you, and good for the consultants coming forward mm-hmm. with that. So, anything else?
And this wouldn't be the question on the affordable growth or as the consensus. However, I am concerned about the flow. Next week is a workshop only, with no action by the county commissioners.
Correct.
Because a lot of times these meetings, which I have watched, have been on Tuesdays, watched back after they've happened, that there is a lot of dialogue in the legislators over at the county commission. Attorney, is it legal that we charge them, that the school charges them? And they're saying, no, is it legal? And there'll be dialogue, you mean, is it legal that we collect it? No, is it legal that they actually charge it? And there's all this dialogue that's kind of open-ended questions, and we're not there present. So I want to make sure that this board, staff will be there, but I just wish I knew what happens after the workshop on Wednesday, because although our staff is very competent, we are policy setters, and I want to make sure if the Board of County Commissioners are trying to not respect our policy wishes, or there's a lot of dialogue, but at least there's somebody there to discuss it. I don't know when that timetable is. Mm-hmm. Do you know what happens after next Wednesday is my question.
Yeah. I think, first of all, going with the consensus from this afternoon is completely defensible. And the report that you guys have seen is a report the Board of County Commissioners are going to see. I do think that the questions will come up and that your staff will be there to answer. Well, if the question comes up, well, what would you spend it on? What do you have on the horizon? And I think you've got the answers. And you've got the North County areas. You've got sub-areas of the district that clearly are going to be needing capacity. So I think you've got those answers. Our board will give us direction, and I think the earliest we will be able, and I'm actually kind of hoping that we could have residential impact fees back before them to adopt in mid-July. So I think there's, we'll know, and you all will know, I think, at the end of next Wednesday, at the end of the workshop, what direction that they want to go. But I think the consensus you guys have expressed is pretty consistent with what they've expressed as well. They've pretty much adopted the affordable growth methodology with a few tweaks here and there for services that are peculiar to us and not you all. So I don't make predictions, but I know better than that. It doesn't mean I don't, but I think we'll all know where things are at the end of next Wednesday.
And this will be reviewed every 2 to 3 years, right?
Yes.
We'll start in 3 years, but it'll take us another year.
I think another thing to keep in mind in terms of schools and our school that closed is that we've also increased the number of students in our schools. And we've had to build out, for example, in Fellsbury, the population has increased so much, and that school was at capacity. And I bet you it was probably cheaper to add buildings, fix the cafeteria, then build an entire new facility. Mm-hmm. So that's been the district strategy. I did have a question in terms of the formula we're using. It seems like we're the only, what are other school districts doing relative to their impact fees? What formulas do they use?
Actually, Nijin, I know you guys have data on a lot of other districts, and I guess there have been other districts that have kind of discounted their fees, but can you kind of summarize that for us?
Yeah, the consumption-based calculations we have is pretty commonly used, and then in many times jurisdictions adopted at a lower rate, especially more recently with the economic downturn. And I think that's kind of how our affordable growth approach started. Jurisdictions were picking a random number to discount, and we tried to add some information to it to show at what point you start affecting the level of service and, what is a good break point. So when looking at the comparables that we included in the report, those are adopted anywhere from 25% to 100% from the calculated fee. But I think those percentages are kind of a pure policy, really not so much backed with any calculation, just kind of like maybe looking around the other jurisdictions, trying to match them, or whatever the community is saying, business community is saying. So there's really not a calculation behind those numbers.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Ms. Disney.
When I took the finance class for school board members, one of the rules of thumb that they taught us was you just take a student station cost and amortize it over the number of years you use it, and if you come up with a number that you can multiply by the student generation rate, then that gives you the ballpark of your impact fee, and we're right in that ballpark.
Oh, good. There you go.
That was the same one.
It's good to have. Hey, it's good to have confirmation.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ms. Disney, very much.
Anything else?
Just the last question.
The consumption base, though, is a year behind because you have to use last year's consumption.
Yeah, your data is. Yeah, I mean, your data is what it's like. Comps. Okay. It's like comps in real estate.
Yeah.
So you're gonna have. You try to have the best available data, but it's always going to be old, and especially by the time you get through adopting.
Well, and the reason I ask is because the 3 years trending, and then another year to figure it out. We're on the upward trend, but a year behind.
That's right.
So
that's right.
Okay.
We're just trying to be less behind.
We're looking at. Hello.
Yes.
We're all here.
We're looking at like 15 years worth of data in the last 3 years and costs and everything else, and trying to project out the next three. So we have looked at, you know, when you peaked in 08 and all the different trends. So we are trying to estimate what your true costs are going to be over the next 3 to 5 years based on looking at 10 to 15 years worth of data. So we think it's the best set of data you can look at to try to project the next 3 years. Now, nobody has a perfect crystal ball, but this is a really good set of data, and we work with your staff to say, given everything we know about the last 3 to 5 years, the last 10 or 15, the trends in land, the trends in cost, this is what your costs are going to be over the next 3 to 5 years.
Well, and I think, Mr. Tyndale, that you all come up with the data information, and then governing boards such as the school board and the county commission, they have to come up with the political side of that equation,
yeah.
Which there is no data for, sir. I'm sorry. I don't think there ever will be, but you're absolutely right, and we do thank you. And this board, I think, always is looking for more additional information. We didn't mean this to turn into a workshop as such, but we really and truly do appreciate the fact that that both Mrs. Camp and Mr. Tyndale were available by phone, and that we had both Mr. Mattson and Mr. Bowling here, and we had our staff here. This is the kind of this is beneficial, and I appreciate my fellow board members allowing this rather than it turning into a long two and a half hour workshop. So thank you very much. And
thank you.
Mr. Tyndale and Ms. Camp, thank you very much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. And thank you all very much.
Thank you,
Stan.
Thank you, Stan.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Morrison.
Thank you.
Thank you. And will the last one to leave the room please close the door?
Will do.
Somebody turned
it
off.
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Simchek, you have any items? Ms. Disney?
Questions. The earful sessions that we've been invited to,
mm-hmm.
looks like they've expanded out from 2 sessions to 3 times. Is that a good
thing? No. Actually, there's 4 days, but it's 2 days for each group. So there are 2 different cohorts, and each of the cohorts has 2 days.
Okay. So is it valuable to go to one of the 2 days if you don't have 2 days to go?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes. I think you would get a good view of how it operates.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I just needed a point of clarification before we get into all the things. Sorry. Okay, Ms. Jimenez.
Yes, I just have a... Let's see. I just wanted to make a... Just to share with the board, you know, we all meet with Dr. Adams separately, and we all bring our passions to the table, and we don't often share those passions with fellow board members. So I just wanted to share one of the things that I've been asking Dr. Adams about has been be really interested in understanding the data behind the students in our middle schools who are behind, like they enter seventh grade behind, and sometimes they're retained and sometimes they're not. Then they move into eighth grade and they're behind and they can't go to ninth grade. And we have quite a few students that fall in that range, and sometimes when they get to eighth grade, sometimes they get counseled out to take the GED. And I'm just trying to understand, and I've asked Dr. Adams for that information, because especially now that legislatively school districts are mandated to do what Erfel mentioned that they are going to do, which is to keep track of these kids and figure out when they're at risk so that they can be dealt with before they're overwhelmed with the number of credits they have to catch up on. So I think it really falls in neatly with what the district is planning to do, but I think it would be helpful to us as we meet to set goals to have some of those numbers to understand, you know, are we talking about 50 kids? Are we talking about 300 kids? What is that reality and what can be done about it? So I know that, you know, sometimes to request information, it's good to know that other board members want that information.
So I just wanted to put that out.
Yeah. Mrs. Simchak, or Mrs. Jimenez and I have talked about it, and we are going talked about making the data available after school was out and grades have been completed. And what has happened over the last, I think it's been 3 or 4 years now, I can't remember, when legislation occurred that a student could not go on to high school to the ninth grade until they passed every core class in middle school. So if a student does not pass every core class in 6th grade, 7th grade, and 8th grade, they are unable to move on. That changed middle schools in Florida because they had to start course recovery. And so that data has changed over the time because of that. And so, what I told her is we'll provide that data. We're just waiting until school's out. And how many students have been retained, we can do that in the 8th grade for the last 3 years to get a sense of what that information looks like. How are students making up the credits? She's requested that, and I said we're willing to do it, but we want to do it at a time when we've got good data.
Sure. Oh, and I appreciate the fact that we always, as individuals, I've seen things that all of us have requested, and you do share that information with all of us,
yes,
not just with the person requesting. So
right,
we have a pretty good idea what people's individual passions are. So, okay.
I would say I would be very interested.
So we'll all get the information.
Oh, yes. Yeah, and I think that is important for you to know, because when somebody asks, first of all, I think you have to be careful about not everybody asking for lots of reports and so on. You know what I mean?
Right.
Individual, you know, board members. However, these are pieces and parts that are part of EARFL. It's part of the work that we're doing, so I think it's very timely and relevant. And when I give Mrs. Jimenez or Mrs. Simchak a report, we send it out to everybody. We make sure everybody has it.
Well, I have a concern around this issue. You know, I remember when we were holding the kids back in third grade,
mm-hmm,
and we ended up with this swelling of kids in fifth grade that were overaged kids,
mm-hmm,
and that spurred us on to do the single gender classrooms because we had these, you know, kids that were shaving in class with little tiny girls, you know, with that discrepancy in age. And we're going to have the same thing now in eighth grade,
mm-hmm,
with, you know, well,
yep,
much older boys,
yes,
with younger girls. And have you already started that conversation of what we're going to do about that? Like, if we're going to have to change the way we matriculate those kids somehow?
The schools have been. Yes, we are dealing with that now. I would venture to say that every middle school might have a 15-year-old student, you know, in the eighth grade who's gotten behind you know, over time. And the what we try and do with that, and we used to have, well, we still have the performance base, but, you know, the problem is you are given so few options today in terms of how a student can go through mm-hmm. the grades. You cannot put them in high school, you know. Mm-hmm. So they the schools really work hard during the school year to make up the courses. They don't wait until the end. We have students that at the fourth 9 weeks are going to have to be making up some credits because of the fourth 9 weeks, but what they do do is they're working harder and harder to get keep students on track by starting them early in these course these recoveries. And the other thing that has changed that I think is student-centered is before they would have to start over in a semester. So if you get to the end of the semester and you've fallen behind, you have to start over, you have to make up that whole semester. So now what they have done is they are creating packets of information to get the students caught up as they go along so that the student isn't sitting at a computer trying to make up a, you know, an entire semester. But I think that has been a more successful approach that they've done in this year. I think was the first year that they've tried to address that in a different way because they've been in the seat, they've done some of the work, and quite frankly, that's why we look at grading practices. Sometimes because they haven't done their homework or they haven't turned the project in, they end up, you know, getting a bad grade where if they're given extended time or if they're working with them as they go along, the students can be successful. So they are trying some different techniques with that.
And are those students eligible for the mid-year promotion as well as the high school students?
They can if they have taken some credits while they're still middle school. That's the other thing that they'll counsel some of these older students. If they only have one course to make up, first of all, they really work hard in the summer to try and do that. But then if not, they try and have them possibly take some online first semester courses, ninth grade, so that when you go on to the high school, you're not behind in credits. Because mm-hmm. you go in mid-semester, you're behind in other things. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's a real juggling act to do that. But those are the kind of things that they take into consideration as they look at those students.
Mr. McCain? Okay, back to me. And I apologize for the sidebar over there, but I did not want to surprise Ms. DeBresta. Dr. Adams and I talked about schools of innovation, and she brought to us that Highlands would like to rename their school and all that. So I wanted Ms. DeBresta and Dr. Adams both to talk a little bit about that because it is the board's policy. It is policy that the board members, the board, names schools. And I want to make sure we're not stepping off the grid and doing something we shouldn't be doing. But I also want to look at the big picture. And we have a, only because I've experienced this over the years, we've had a couple of schools over the years where you've had a group of students very involved in naming their school. Mr. McCain's a good example. His elementary school, was their mascot was named the Mustangs, and then all of a sudden there was a new principal, and he decided he was just going to arbitrarily change it to the Panthers, and they became the Panthers. So kids who went home who didn't
really
did go. Oh yes,
I've got a Rosewood Mustang shirt at the house. I still got it. It's got that. Like all the whole graduating fifth grade on it.
And so those fifth graders leave, but then you have these other kids who come back, and all of a sudden their school mascot, they have all this stuff, their school mascot, I mean, there was Mustang money you could earn, or you could go buy stuff. I mean, it was, you know, typical elementary school activities. But we need to be looking at the big picture of, you know, what a decision in allowing a school to decide to change its name and the reason for it, and how it is affected by policy. So let's start with okay. Dr. Adams, if we could, please.
And everybody knows nobody can change their name without the board,
right.
You know. So they already know that.
Yes,
you know.
They do.
Okay, and we are talking about Highlands, and as you heard this morning, there is lots of energy and a lot of good things happening at Highlands right now, and they're trying to change their image. You know, right now they have an image, and so they had a lot of different ideas, but when it came down to it, I said, your best chance of this happening is to keep Highlands there. you know, because it is a geographic, it's, and, you know, one of our policies relate to that. So then they had come up of the idea with the Highlands Academy or Highlands Prep School. And so they were trying to put something on the end of it that would could imply, you know, something different other than Highlands Elementary. Mm-hmm. So those are the ideas that they have brought forward. Not to change the Highlands piece, but how about Prep or Highlands Academy? They want to have a different connotation so that people will stop and come to their school before they decide they're going to go somewhere else. Because one of the things that we found with schools like Dodgertown and Highlands is a parent never steps foot on the school, ever. They make a decision based on what they hear and what their perception is about it, and they have never stepped foot on it. And so they want people to take a second thought, and they want to have that opportunity to invite them there so they can find out what's going on. So that's their rationale for wanting to do this.
Yes, Ms. Mendes.
So will they keep the mascot?
Yes, I haven't heard anything about the bear going away.
So what are they, fighting insurance?
The bear. They're
bears.
Oh, they're bears.
Bears.
Yeah.
So, Ms. DiAgresta, I asked Ms. DiAgresta was, we made Rosewood a magnet. We made, mm-hmm. I mean, those kinds of things, but... So we needed to discuss how this was going to be done. So, Ms. DiAgresta, if you...
Certainly, as part of your rulemaking process back in August of 2013, one of the rules that you touched briefly was your facility naming rule. You do have one, and it's broken into a couple different parts. One has to do with new facilities as they come online and your process for naming them. And there's also a paragraph that deals with existing facilities and the possibility of renaming them if that ever presents itself to you. But your policy talks about a process. There should be a name selection team, and the policy actually defines who's a member on that team, and they're to meet and decide about a recommendation. They're to do it by a majority vote. I mean, you know, we get them into the procedure so that they have a way to make a decision. They make then their decision. They give it to the principal. The principal then recommends it to the superintendent, who comes and recommends it to you, you know, for you to decide upon. So there is a process in your policy to be followed, and I'm sure that once they work their way through everything, mm-hmm. there'll be a recommendation for you to consider. Yeah.
Now, they've had a committee at the school to discuss this, and this was a recommendation that they brought forward. So, yeah.
So what are we talking about?
No, we just needed a point of clarification, because this will be coming before us, and we want to make certain that, you know, that this has been followed so that no one can come forward and take mm-hmm. exception to anything that's being said. We, as individual board members in the community, can say the process was followed. It was not... Because where the initial discussion was that they were going, you know, the comment, I believe, was under your matters. Mm-hmm. At the end of one of the board meetings, you did mention that. Mm-hmm. We need to make certain that we can, with authority, we can say mm-hmm. all of the protocols. Did you see it up there? I'm so proud.
I know, I was looking at you.
You gave me the look. It was up there, big. Loved it. I want to get them to do my
Protocol dance.
We need to make certain that we can answer within the community that all of these. This is not a top-down decision. This is a decision that our policy was followed. Well, if there hadn't been at least one remark, this discussion wouldn't be taking place. So we just need to clarify.
Okay.
Ms. Simpson. Ms. Disney. Ms. Jimenez.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on how we talked a little bit about course recovery, and I know that we changed what we were doing, and we're now using Florida Virtual School. How is that going? I've heard some mixed reviews.
We use Florida Virtual School in middle school this year, and virtual is not necessarily a good option. That's what we found out. Mm-hmm. And so, actually, we have purchased the upgraded A+, and they have it's aligned more to the Common Core mm-hmm. now. And so they are going to be, they have developed and are continuing to develop the lessons, mm-hmm. and it will be using the A+. Yes, we tried Florida Virtual, and Florida Virtual, you know, you can't get on it until they have space. So we actually had students waiting to be able to sign up. And that was kind of an unexpected, when they did the contract, that was kind of an unexpected thing that happened. So here you have students that are already behind and having to wait until they can get in. And I think the other thing that we've really learned is virtual isn't necessarily a good option for a lot, especially for struggling students. So while a lot of it will be online, it's more of a blended. They're putting teachers in the classroom, in the labs with the students to assist certified teachers. So if you're taking math, you know, you're with the A+, you're also having a math teacher. So it's a more of a blended learning than an online.
And will the district be providing data at the end of the summer in terms of how many students took this in each grade level, and mm-hmm. what was the pass rate, and do we track them?
Sure. Oh, yeah.
To see how they're doing?
Well, I don't know that we track them to see how they're doing. We know whether they moved on to the next level or not. They've met the requirements to be able to move on to the next grade.
You know, it might be interesting to track them because, if, for example, there's a student that's behind in math, and they do the course recovery piece during the summer, and so they take that box off of their to-do list, but if they don't have a good foundation and they're struggling in math, then maybe you need to look at what's being done to make sure that they are getting that foundation that they need. You know, it's like they take it, they pass it, but is it effective mm-hmm. for them building on to their future math? Or is that, just not a...
We're tracking a lot of things. So I'm not saying it isn't. I just think that what I would want you to do is honor the fact that when one thing doesn't work, we don't stay with it, you know, that we're not here to just keep doing the same thing, but to try to provide a different delivery that's going to have more students successful. I will also tell you that the course recovery is not always about students who can't do the work. It's a lot of other reasons why students aren't performing. In some cases, it's because they can do it. They think they can do it faster, you know, than doing the work in class. You know, we found that with the A+ because it was at an easier level, so it was like, well, why put in the time? So it's kind of a constant renewal and continuing to look at it. That's why they went to online, thinking that was going to be held them more accountable. And so now we're back to more of a blended, you know, learning. So I think what we continue to monitor is what's the success rate. You know, I think that's important, those kind of things that you're saying. And how many students are being retained. And
I think it's wonderful that we're doing the blended. That's really kudos to the school district. That's awesome.
Okay, Mr. McCain. We're back around to me, and I don't have anything else. Ms. Sinchik, you have something to say?
I do.
Did I forget you?
Yes.
No, I didn't. I went Miss Simchick, and then I went Miss Dizzy, and then I went Miss Bennett.
Sorry, I thought we were going to take that a different order. Sorry.
Well, my apologies. Miss Dizzy.
We'll
all right. Miss Simchick.
No, just the odd.
Miss Dizzy. Okay.
I know.
Each year I get this phone call, and each year I bring it up. You know, parents constantly want to know why we can't create some form of district calendar so that there are not so many overlapping events. And particularly because, you know, in the North County, if you have a child in elementary, high school, middle school, mm-hmm. and they have everything on Thursday night, you have to pick and choose of what you're going to go to. So it seems to me that electronically in this day and age, there should be a way for a principal or whoever does scheduling to, even if it meant emailing the next school and saying, God, do you have anything important happening Thursday night? I'm putting something in. We need to do something
about that because everything piles up.
That's relationships.
Yeah. It is.
Well, it's so much more complex than just saying that. I mean, if you look at a school calendar, it's crazy. But here's what we do have. We have websites at every school. You know what I mean? So we do have an online way for you to, because I know there are parents that have kids in Sebastian Elementary, maybe Sebastian River Middle and Sebastian River High School, and trying to blend the calendars for all of that is, I'm not sure that it would make sense to, you know, in trying to look at it, but I do feel good about the fact that we've got a website for every school and that the calendars are on that website. It's just amazing to me all of the events that schools have every single week. You know, so.
But maybe in your principal's meeting you could remind them that they perhaps, when setting their events, they may want to make certain that other schools in their community area, that there's not a conflict. I know it used to be that, you know, Tuesday nights were PTA meetings all over the county on Tuesday nights. And that was because, you know, it just was understood. Yeah. That was what was happening in the culture. But
yeah. Well, here's what I can do is, like, at a principal's meeting, talk to them about theater groups. You know,
you
kind
go.
Of have that theater group.
Yeah.
That if you would do the, you know, maybe make a more concerted effort to talk, especially on bigger events, you know, to see that there isn't, you know, to try and not to have overlaps. But I think maybe the feeder groups would be a better way to.
We're not talking about baseball conflicts. No, we're not talking about.
But the end of the year high school concert and the elementary fifth grade graduation on the same night creates conflicts for families. And so we just need an awareness that. To go that extra mile in your schedule and try not to step on another event in the future.
And I think that's what, you know, you said relationships, and in the end, that's really what it's about. It's those relationships and being mindful. But I think we also have to be realistic that there is so much going on in our school district that you just sometimes you are going to have to make choices. And, you know, because it's also really stressful when you're trying to find the perfect date and there's always going to be something that somebody wants to go to. But I think that being mindful and reminding the principals, because maybe they could do that extra check.
The comment about the feeder, the feeders to a particular school, I think is certainly
and
appropriate.
And what do they consider the major events? Because there are lots of other things, but if they could coordinate a little bit more on those major events, you know, then they might be able to.
Okay. We have anything else? Yes, Ms. Disney. I forgot you twice. Okay, let's see. Mr. McCain doesn't have anything, and I don't have anything. And Ms. Sinchin didn't have anything. Ms. Disney, do you have anything?
One other parent-related issue. Over the years, we've had a number of coaches who were not renewed. And, you know, coaches have a personal relationship with the families and the kids. So for some parents, they're really glad that coach is gone. And for other parents, they really can't stand to see him go. So I understand my role as a board member, and I have nothing to say about the people that are non-renewed. But what the parents have asked me is, isn't there some step in between somebody calling and saying, you've got to fire that coach because he didn't play my son? And then, you know, what's the other side of the story? There's always the other side of the story. So they were recommending perhaps there's a way to have a parent board of some kind, a sounding board, to try to reduce some resolution with the coaches, with the ADs, prior to this revolving door of coaches that we have. Because at Vero Beach High School particularly, there's the feeling from those parents that there's political pressure to replace coaches and that they don't necessarily have to do anything wrong. They just can't get on the wrong side of certain people. They want to keep their job.
That may be the perception.
Yeah.
I don't believe it's the reality. I would want every board member to know that they have spent a lot of time interviewing students and parents on issues. And I think Mr. Fritz said it well this morning. You know, there are ethical decisions to be made regarding how we treat students and how coaches and everybody else. And some accusations are true, some accusations aren't. But we have a responsibility to make sure that we look into all of that. Mm-hmm. And in the, at the end of the day, there will be some people that will agree with what you did and some people that don't agree, and you get into the world of athletics and competition and playtime and what are the teams that go all over and play now? Yeah, you know, travel. You've got traveling teams, you've got, you know, these teams, and it becomes more complex, but there's been a lot of work done this spring and talking to a lot of people, not just parents, but students and coaches, and we're looking at ethics mm-hmm. on teams.
I think the suggestion came out because at that school there's a much higher attrition rate than you mm-hmm. see at many other schools. So that's mm-hmm. why the parents mm-hmm. were thinking when yeah. they came to me that there was another level in there that perhaps they could avoid some of this stuff. Because rumors tend to take on lives of their own, and that it's so pervasive. That, mm-hmm.
It's essential. I just have a lot of experience in that sports thing.
Then that committee becomes the they didn't play my ball, and that daddy. Well, if that committee is made up of an outside source, it's all about their kid and their kid's playtime. Yeah. Plain and simple. It happens in travel ball, happens in high school sports, happens with the coach, but he gets an assistant dad mm-hmm. outside of the school district employee. That's not paid, that just helps me out as a third or first base coach. Mm-hmm. And then that child who is not as skilled as other kids miraculously plays, but you can't really say that because what's your proof? Because you think that kid doesn't play? And it just turns into a big... I agree with you because I see that happening. Yeah. But it's a perception on parents, as Dr. Adams said, sometimes real and sometimes so unreal. And so if you created a committee or if they had say, the say would be to benefit their child, and that's the bottom line if they get into it. I know that because I see it.
Well, even if they didn't have say, I just can't. Just like I said when we were talking about how we were going to categorize our quasi-judicial and those kinds of things, when I said I don't feel, no matter what has happened with a teacher, I don't want that teacher to be that whole thing process to be laid out in front of everyone. Mm-hmm. I just don't believe that. But I also feel that once you have this kind of a committee, you don't have a committee without empowering them for something. Mm-hmm. Any group, whether you call them a committee
sure.
or whether you go to a meeting of a bunch of parents, they feel empowered. Mm-hmm. They have a group and they feel empowered. So I definitely would not be supportive of that. I appreciate how active, and I've talked to two young men so far who were on your, or two young students who were on your student
advisory.
Your student advisory, and they, I mean, they really think that they have really had a voice heard. They really feel like you listen to them and that you responded to them, and that everything they talked about was important to you. And, you know, not related to two different schools, the two different schools I had gone to. And the one was with his dad, and his dad said, you know, he comes home and talks about the meetings, his county office meetings. His county office meetings. It feels like, you know. But he did say, both of them said, they felt as though their voice was being heard. So, and that's the appropriate level for that.
Yeah.
So, what I hear you saying is that everything is investigated.
Yes, it is.
Positive
yes,
and
it
negative.
Is. Yes,
and
it
there
is.
There are no assumptions made.
Yeah. This is what I'm asking you, board, is to trust. You know, you won't necessarily. You may not agree with the final decision because of what you've heard and so on and so forth. But I'm asking you to trust that it's all investigated. It's listening to all parties, and decisions are made on what we think is best in the long run for kids.
Well, and it's a statement today. You need to be
you need to have trust, but you also need to be trustworthy. And I think that we've changed that focus. We're getting, you know, that pendulum swinging.
And there's been a lot of suggestions back to coaches about what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, and so yeah, they've had their share this spring, let me tell you.
I did want to
let me say one more thing about that. We said, I mean, because this is, it's, I mean, everybody's talking about it. I've heard from, you know, several board members, is what we've said to Vero Beach High School is you've got to set the stage of expectations for coaches and students. And this, to me, is saying, get the handbook, get it out, use it, talk to everybody about what the expectations are of all groups, and then as you move forward, you've covered, you know, that. But I think there's some work to be done there.
I just want to say I really empathize with you, because that's my biggest grab in the corner. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think I shared with Dr. Adams, I mean, I already have people telling me about a rumor for next January's baseball team, out of district kids are going to come in because they know that coach. And I'm like, you know, the thing is that, And this is why with sports, you know, with the economy and with scholarships and with grades and with sports, a lot of parents are seeing this, besides their number one fan of their child, but they're also looking at his scholarships and things like that. And it's just it's a very passionate subject. Mm-hmm. And so, it's on the little league field or just anywhere, I mean, we're getting cornered, I should say. And I don't mind being cornered on any, and I don't want to use the word cornered, I don't approached on this. This is, that's like a large chunk of the community coming up to me, so I understand what you're saying. And it's just, it's difficult. It's just as difficult as changing personnel in schools. It's funny that a coach, but that's the way they feel. Changing a coach is like changing a principal. And they get very passionate over that. And so I get those conversations as well.
And it really comes down to the people in charge having the highest level of integrity and being able to take responsibility for the decisions they make. Mm-hmm. Because if there's any kind of ambiguity.
Makeup girl.
I was trying to combine a couple of words. If there's any ambiguity when speaking with the parents, the parents are going to distrust the system and feel that because people can smell when something's off, they just don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. So the trust, what we heard this morning from Mr. Fritz really resonated with me, though, that we have to be trusting and trustworthy when we say something. They have to know that's what really happened. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Great.
Anything else? Hearing none.
We're not going to do committee reports.
Sorry. Board committee reports, Ms. Jimenez. Mr. McCain. Ms. Jimenez.
Okay, yes. I went to the Economic Development Council meeting, and I have copies for all of you. There was a very informative presentation by the county attorney, and his assistant was the one that did most of the talking, and that was the handout that was given, and there was an opportunity for questions and answers around that. And then there was also a reminder for the State of the Region event on June 20th. And is that the event that the superintendent?
No,
that's State of the Region. You're doing State of the County. So this is the State of the Region.
Yeah, but the State of the County, I'm not doing that. They said it. I got to know about this.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay. So disappointing.
It is disappointing.
But it's going to go just
to
yours.
Well, they have to. The county has to agree to relinquish some of their time, and if they don't, then they won't. And so
they didn't.
So they won't. We knew that all hinged on that.
Okay. And then the other meeting that I attended was the School Health Advisory Council meeting, and the issue of the nurses and the ratios was brought up yet again. And I shared this information with Dr. Adams, and I believe she's on it. So I just wanted, you know, because we spent a lot of time listening to that conversation. And there was also a conversation about the community gardens. And
where was that?
That's about it.
Where was the community gardens discussed?
at the School Health Advisory Council meeting.
Oh.
It was interesting because somebody actually talked about, you know, and today we saw a little bit about that. The kids get the tomatoes and whatnot, and they give them to the teacher or to other people because the health department policies and laws would never allow for those foods to be used in our school cafeteria, so they have to be given to someone. And what else? And there will be a report, the School Health Advisory Council. I think that was their last meeting.
Oh,
because
okay.
they don't, the last meeting was May 21st.
Okay.
And so there will be a report coming forth, and once that report is printed, I will make sure everybody gets a copy. And then there was just another piece of feedback when we were talking about the nurse ratios. You know, we were having that conversation here, and it was commented that, you know, 911 is always available. And actually, the staff that was there said, you know, there's so many low-priority issues that you could never call 911 for, and those disproportionate ratios, you know, are a concern, specifically from that perspective. So you will be getting a report with their summary of what they've accomplished during the year. And right now they're working on the school health plan.
I didn't mean to laugh. I was having been a 911 dispatcher for 19 years when you said that they couldn't call. Well, believe me, they did. Anyway, and you tell them the non-emergency number is this. Two things. The report you gave us, I just wanted to point everybody's direction to what are the quiet zones, which I is popping out of my
Item G.
It says... It's the last bullet point. Per federal regulation, only an entity with jurisdiction over the road that crosses the track can apply for a quiet zone, which concerned me for Gifford Middle. And I think we had talked about maybe trying to find out what our availability is for quiet zones. So that is disappointing, but I don't know if that's something we should be making Phil Mattson, who was just here earlier, aware of. So... do you know where I'm going with that?
We'll find out.
Yeah. So that's
I'll
a curiosity on that.
Mr. Morrison and if we can get
Sanders.
Back with that information in our next discussion session.
And then I just wanted to add, because I get a lot of the phone calls from people, I think we had Ms. Ginn here the last meeting, and I just wanted to, because I've never brought this up in a discussion meeting, and the concern, or for some reason, and I got an email, too, on it from a different person, that the public is fearful that we are going away from our...
abstinence-based.
Thank you. It's rolling around up there. Policy. We haven't changed. That is the adopted policy of the school district. Okay.
Ms. Disney.
Yes.
Hey,
the old board, Florida... issue is across many community meetings. I'm on MPO, and they've actually created a permanent agenda item for MPO for All Board Florida now in each MPO meeting. So I've requested twice about getting the impact to Gifford Middle School and to transportation, and I'm wondering how that's progressing. There'll be some information forthcoming. And the reason I think that it needs to be put on the fast track is because today in a conversation with Mr. Bowling, he said getting that information after the impact report's already finished and published is not going to be helpful. Any mitigation that we're going to have, power is prior to it all happening, not after the fact. So,
No. Mr. Sanders was here last time that we talked about the all aboard, and so I've got a report here I'll share with you, and we can.
So,
I don't know that there's anything to know. I don't know whether anybody knows anything right now, you know.
Well, an engineer would be able to tell us if there's going to be a financial impact to give the middle school to any of the sensitive areas, and then the transportation department would need to let us know what kind of time delays we should expect, because we have buses that cross the tracks both east and westbound twice a day. So
do they have enough information available that we can find out these type of things?
That's information they rely on us to provide.
they won't provide that to us. We need to provide that to them.
So if I'm hearing you right, what we have to do is ask transportation about the bus routes,
yes.
And then there will be two trips a day. There'll be two school and...
How many trips a day?
Two per route, I should say. So how many routes go over that track and two trips per day?
And not just at Giffords.
Would be affected. Giffords Middle School would be affected. Probably Sebastian Elementary.
I don't know. I'm not sure what you're asking, but we'll work on this.
All right. What she's asking is how many, if we are looking at all of North Florida train,
right?
How many buses in the do we have? How many buses do we have in the AM and in the PM that cross the train tracks for student transportation?
Okay.
Because that's information that MPO need. I mean, sorry. MPO needs. For us to say what impact is going to be. Engineer or Mr. Sanders is pretty smart about some of this. We don't have to hire an engineer unless he feels it's that, or you feel it's that important, as to what the impact would be, how far away Giffords Middle School is from the train track, and will there be an impact to the school itself in any way? And we need to get, and I know you brought this up before, we need to get that information so that it can be shared with the entity. We can't share a concern.
That's
it's all yours.
Sorry,
I wrote it down.
I wrote it down.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Mine
has no
idea. Do you have anything else? The only other thing was, I think this is a better venue for it than the meeting tonight, and I go to all the ROTC events, and it was so meaningful to them that they were recognized here in Chambers. I was kind of overwhelmed with my emotions as they you presented, because I spend a lot of time with those kids and those instructors, and it really was meaningful to them. They're very seldom recognized for the amount of work they do.
Well, we had planned to do this last year, and unfortunately, when I remembered it, and we already had one of the high schools had already presented for the last time that school year last year, so we weren't going to just do one school. So this year, dear Miss Stang put it on her tickler, and she reminded me early on, so we got it taken care of.
Good job.
And I do thank. Having the plaque, we decided it was an arbitrary decision. Didn't cost any money. Blanks were already available, and two little pieces of paper, but something that could be presented so that the school had it in their ROTC offices. So I hope it's something that you all will continue after.
I hope so too. And the amount of recognition that we've done in the school board recently, I think, has impacted the community, and I think they want to see more of that. So I hope we'll keep that in mind going forward. The little videos that we run at the end of the meeting, we can replay these things. We can play while we're waiting for board meetings to start. I think the public is hungry for this positive information. They're just so overwhelmed by the negative information from the press, from the media, that if we don't put out the positive, who will?
I don't have any reports, but I do have a reminder that John Ehrman is here to speak to the board about signs for trespassing on school property.
You're up.
So my apologies. I apologize, Mr. Ehrman.
Who's been trespassing?
Nobody.
Not.
Everybody.
The presentation is
going to
be, we're
going to
put up signs. Thank you.
Okay.
Welcome.
Hello again. Thanks for the great state of the thing.
Out there,
thank you.
We had a comment the other day that the Sebastian River High School is starting to look like the Hilton.
Woohoo!
Where were they standing when they made it?
On the good side.
At their best side.
Yes, dim lighting, candle light.
Profile.
So sorry. Okay, so done.
We brought this to the SLC, and Dr. Adams thought that it should be brought to your attention for a call, a decision. We've had several incidents in the past, and over the years, quite a few incidents that have caused pause for people using playgrounds, sports facilities, all of our facilities, the gyms, everything else, without authorization.
Tracks, stairs, the citrus bowl.
Just about all of our facilities. Just about everything. Yeah. And it's become somewhat of a liability issue at times. It's taken a step now towards a stronger vandalism step, which is what brought it here. The liability side, we just keep running people off. When they start tearing things up, that's a different, gives us a little more pause for we need to do something. We looked at our posting around the district. We have various signs scattered. It's not a district-wide sign, and it's not enforced district-wide by the Sheriff's Department uniformly. What this would be pointed at is there's a group of the people that are unauthorized to use our facilities. There's probably the top 10% are the bad ones. A lot of them are kids jumping the fence and doing a lap around the track and then jumping and running back out. There's not a lot we can do about that. We do have fences and all that. But there's some of them that are leaving whiskey bottles, and they're tearing up gates. Big kids getting on primary playgrounds that we're about to put in, breaking the swings, breaking the slides, things like that. So we went and looked around and surveyed what we had. We tried to come up with a somewhat docile sign, not something that was threatening. We visited with law enforcement and said, what do we need to put up that enables you to do something with the repeat offenders, so to speak? And so we came up with this, and this is a little more tame than some. What this means is that if a deputy comes up on somebody, if they don't have one of these, or they don't have a card or a letter or something authorizing them to be where they are, then they have the right to, you know, the law enforcement can do what they have to do to get them off.
But if we don't have a posting, they don't have as much authority as an unposted property has less opportunity for them to be involved than a posted property.
That's correct. We had that. We learned that at Alt Education,
right,
where they stole our no trespassing
sign. Right.
So
the reason I wanted to bring it forward is so you understand where they're going to go. You know, he's talking about playgrounds. They're talking about tracks. They're talking about those areas that a day, years ago, you could get on the playground and play, and today we have fences, and we've got people coming in and tearing them up. So I think as a board, you need to be mindful of that this is why the recommendation came forward, but be comfortable.
And I think last year, did we have two groups that there was quite an altercation at one of our schools because there were two groups wanting to use the same facility, maybe the year before last?
Well, there's been multiple strange incidences of people running the stairs at the Citrus Bowl backwards, hopping the stairs, and I mean, some of it's pretty scary.
It's degressed liability-wise. That really doesn't keep us from being liable, though, does it?
No, ma'am. As the owner of property, unless it is a trespasser with a trespass warrant sworn against them, in my opinion, you will be liable to some extent for any injury or damage that occurs on your property.
You have a question, Ms. Sencha?
That being said, though, isn't it more... although we will be liable, at least wouldn't that be more defendable that we made the attempt to?
It would be a defense, and I assure you the defense would be made, but I doubt a jury will give it much monetary value. The claim would still go forward. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so we need a consensus board. Do you think this is a nice docile town?
It doesn't say junkyard dogs.
So, any objections to this? Maybe that's what I should say. All right. Yes,
it's not an objection. I just think it's a sad state of affairs that we have taxpayer dollars and we have facilities when we talk about things like obesity, you know, blah, 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 that there isn't a way of having a happy medium. But I know that liability is liability and there's nothing we can do about it, so we have to protect ourselves, but it's just a shame.
Okay.
I would just like to see that posted frequently. Like if there's two entrances to a, you know, I mean, I would like to see it. If we're going to post it. I want to see it posted.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you're going to go one way, you might as well go one way. Is that just my, otherwise you just have measures.
Okay.
We don't want docile placement.
It'll be obvious.
Put a please after that.
Right. I like the non-docile.
All right, right.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Dr. Adams, did you have anything else?
No.
I didn't give you an opportunity. No. So.
I said my piece.
What about the ones with the whiskey bottle? Big kids on the little playground in the whiskey bottle, they're not going to be able to read this song.
I kind of got your train of thought. On the swings, the big kids are not going to be able to read the signs. Okay. I don't know what kind of parties you had.
He talked about that.
Yeah, he did. Nothing else to come before us?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I do. A workshop. We have, what is the workshop, Judy? Oh, performance assessment. We had FPNL and Con Edison come in again to talk with us. Last year you approved an RFP. They've done some studies on some schools. They'd like to be able to come back and we'd like to bring forward. And we were looking at June 24th. I don't think Mrs. Jimenez is going to be
what
here.
What else do we have on June 24th?
We have a board meeting. And we don't have any other workshops.
But it is a board meeting day.
It is a board meeting day. So if we do it, could do it at 1 o'clock?
Sure.
Okay, and it will be televised, so Mrs. Jimenez could.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Could have a DVD.
Do you want to call it?
Performance assessment for utilities. And
contract.
You know.
Contract.
Yeah. Performance contract. Thank you.
No, thanks, me. Thanks, Ms. Deschrest.
Yeah, energy efficiency performance contracting.
Thank you.
Okay. Are we done?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you, Judy.
Darn it. I'm going to get your full
day. Oh, I know. I can't go either.
Carol, you're